Today's deception did not exclude a reward tomorrow or after tomorrow. Somehow, however, the dream had begun to cloy, and now the book lay on the table, completely enclosed within itself, delimited and concluded, and no longer did it radiate those former powerful, glad rays. A moment later, in bed, just as his thoughts had begun to settle down for the night and his heart to sink in the snow of slumber, he always had palpitations when falling asleep, Fyodor ventured imprudently to repeat to himself the unfinished poem, simply to enjoy it once more before the separation by sleep. But he was weak, and it was strong, twitching with avid life, so that in a moment it had conquered him, covered his skin with goose pimples, filled his head with a heavenly buzz. And so he again turned on the light, lit a cigarette, and lying supine, the sheet pulled up to his chin and his feet protruding like Antokolsky's Socrates, one toe lost to Lugano's damp, abandoned himself to all the demands of inspiration. This was a conversation with 1,000 interlocutors, only one of whom was genuine, and this genuine one must be caught and kept within hearing distance. How difficult this is, and how wonderful. And in these talks between tam-tambles, tam-tam my spirit hardly knows. After some 3 hours of concentration and ardor dangerous to life, he finally cleared up the whole thing to the last word, and decided that tomorrow he would write it down. In parting with it, he tried reciting softly the good, warm, farm-fresh lines. Thank you, my land. For your remotest, most cruel mist, my thanks are due. By you possessed, by you unnoticed, unto myself I speak of you. And in these talks between somnambules, my inmost being hardly knows if it's my demency that rambles or your own melody that grows. And realizing only now that this contained a certain meaning, he followed it through with interest and approved it. Exhausted, happy, with ice-cold souls, the statue lies half-naked in a gloomy park, still believing in the goodness and importance of what he had performed, he got up to turn off the light. In his torn nightshirt, with his skinny chest and long, turquoise-veined, hairy legs exposed, he dawdled by the mirror, still with that same solemn curiosity, examining and not quite recognizing himself, those broad eyebrows, that forehead with its projecting point of close-cropped hair. A small vessel had burst in his left eye, and the crimson invading it from the canthus imparted a certain gypsy quality to the dark glimmer of the pupil. Goodness, what a growth on those hollow cheeks after a few nocturnal hours, as if the moist heat of composition had stimulated the hair as well. He turned the switch, but most of the night had dissolved, and all the pale and chilled objects in the room stood like people come to meet someone on a smoky railroad platform. For a long time he could not fall asleep. Discarded word shells obstructed and chafed his brain and prickled his temples, and there was no way he could get rid of them. Meanwhile, the room had grown quite light, and somewhere, most likely in the ivy, crazy sparrows all together, not listening to each other, shrilled deafeningly. Big recess in a little school. Thus began his life in his new hole. His landlady could not get used to his habits of sleeping till noon, lunching none knew how or where, and dining off greasy wrapping paper. His book of poems did not get any reviews after all. Somehow he had assumed it would happen automatically, and had not even taken the trouble of sending out review copies. Except for a brief note in Vasilyev's Gazeta, signed by the financial correspondent, who expressed an optimistic view of his literary future and quoted one stanza with a deadly misprint. He came to know Tannenberg Street better, and it yielded him all its fondest secrets, such as the fact that next door, in the basement, lived an old shoemaker by the name of Kanarienvogel, and there actually was a birdcage, although minus its yellow captive in his purblind window, among samples of repaired footwear. But as for Fyodor's shoes, the cobbler looked at him over the top of the steel-rimmed spectacles of his guild and refused to repair them. So Fyodor started thinking of buying a new pair. He also learned the name of the upstairs tenants. Having zoomed one day by mistake to the top landing, he read on a brass nameplate, Karl Lorenz, Geschichtsmaler. And one day, Romanov, whom he met at a street corner and who shared a studio in another part of the city with the Geschichtsmaler, told Fyodor a few things about him. He was a toiler, a misanthrope, and a conservative, who had spent his whole life painting parades, battles, the imperial phantom with his star and ribbon, haunting the Sanssouci Park, and who now, in the uniformless Republic, was impoverished and begloomed. He had enjoyed, before 1914, a distinguished reputation, had visited Russia to paint the Kaiser's meeting with the Tsar, and while wintering in St. Petersburg, had met his present wife, Margarita Lvovna, who was, at the time, a young and enchanting dilettante who dabbled in all the arts. His alliance in Berlin with the Russian émigré painter had begun by accident, as a result of a newspaper advertisement. This Romanov was of quite a different cut. Lorenz developed a sullen attachment to him, but since the day of Romanov's first exhibition, in which he showed his portrait of Countess Dex, stark naked with corset marks on her stomach, holding her own self diminished to one-third life-size, had considered him a madman and a swindler. Many, however, were captivated by the young artist's bold and original gift. Extraordinary successes were predicted for him, and some even saw in him the originator of a neo-naturalist school. After passing through all the trials of so-called modernism, he was said to have arrived at a renovated, interesting, and somewhat cold narrative art. In his early works, a certain trace of the cartoonist's style was still evident. For example, in that thing of his called Coincidence, where on an advertising post, among the vivid, remarkably harmonious colors of playbills, astral names of cinemas, and other transparent motley, one could read a notice about a lost diamond necklace with a reward to the finder, which necklace lay right there on the sidewalk at the very foot of the post, its innocent fire sparkling. In his Autumn, though, the black tailor's dummy with its ripped side, dumped in a ditch among magnificent maple leaves, was already expressiveness of a purer quality. Connoisseurs found in it an abyss of sadness. But his best work to date remained one that had been acquired by a discerning tycoon and had already been extensively reproduced, called Four Citizens Catching a Canary. All four were in black, broad-shouldered, top-hatted, although for some reason one of them was barefoot, and placed in odd, exultant, and at the same time wary poses beneath the strikingly sunny foliage of a squarely trimmed linden tree, in which hid the bird, perhaps the one that had escaped from my shoemaker's cage. I was obscurely thrilled by Romanov's strange, beautiful, yet venomous art. I perceived in it both a forestalling and a forewarning. Having far outdistanced my own art, it simultaneously illuminated for it the dangers of the way. As for the man himself, I found him boring to the point of revulsion. I could not stand his extremely rapid, extremely lisping speech, accompanied by a totally irrelevant automatic rolling of his shining eyes. "Listen," he said, spitting at my chin, "why don't you let me introduce you to Margarita Lorenz? She's told me to bring you over some night. Do come, we hold little soirees at the studio. You know, with music, sandwiches, red lampshades. A lot of young people come. The Polonsky girl, the Shidlovsky brothers, Zina Mertz." These names were unknown to me. I felt no desire to spend evenings in the company of Vsyevolod Romanov, nor did Lawrence's pug-faced wife interest me in any way. So not only did I not accept the invitation, but since that time I began avoiding the artist. In the morning, The potato hawker's cry, "Prima kartoffel!" rang out in the street in a high, disciplined sing-song. But how the young vegetable's heart throbs! Or else a sepulchral bass proclaimed, "Blumenerde!" The thump of rugs being beaten was sometimes joined by a hurdy-gurdy, which was painted brown and mounted on squalid cartwheels, with a circular design on its front depicting an idyllic brook. And cranking now with his right hand, now with his left, the sharp-eyed organ grinder pumped out a thick O Sole Mio. That sun was already inviting me into the square. In its garden, a young chestnut tree, still unable to walk alone and therefore supported by a stake, suddenly came out with a flower bigger than itself. The lilacs, however, did not bloom for a long time, but when they finally made up their mind, then within one night, which left a considerable number of cigarette butts under the benches, they encircled the garden with ruffled richness. In a quiet lane behind the church, the locust trees shed their petals on a gray June day, and the dark asphalt next to the sidewalk looked as if cream of wheat had been spilled on it. In the rose beds around the statue of a bronze runner, the Dutch glory disengaged the corners of its red petals and was followed by General Arnold Janssen. One happy and cloudless day in July, a very successful ant flight was staged. The females would take to the air, and the sparrows, also taking to the air, would devour them. And in places where nobody bothered them, they kept crawling along the gravel and shedding their feeble prop-room wings. From Denmark, the papers reported that as a result of a heat wave there, numerous cases of insanity were being observed. People were tearing off their clothes and jumping into the canals. Male gypsy moths dashed about in wild zigzags. The lindens went through all their involved, aromatic, messy metamorphoses. The other, in his shirt sleeves and with sneakers on his sockless feet, would spend the greater part of the day on an indigo bench in the public garden, a book in his long tanned fingers. And when the sun beat down too hard, he would lean his head on the hot back of the bench and shut his eyes for long periods. The ghostly wheels of the city day revolved through the interior bottomless scarlet, and the sparks of children's voices darted past, and the book, open in his lap, became ever heavier and more unbooklike. But now the scarlet darkened under a passing cloud, and lifting his sweaty neck, he would open his eyes and once again see the park, the lawn with its marguerites, the freshly watered gravel, the little girl playing hopscotch with herself, the pram with the baby consisting of two eyes and a pink rattle, and the journey of the blinded, breathing, radiant disk through the cloud. Then everything would blaze once again, and along the dappled street lined with restless trees, a coal truck would thunder by with the grimy driver on his high, bumpy seat, clenching the stalk of an emerald-bright leaf in his teeth. In the late afternoon, he would go to give a lesson to a businessman with sandy eyelashes who looked at him with a dull gaze of malevolent perplexity as Fyodor unconcernedly read him Shakespeare, or to a schoolgirl in a black jumper whom he sometimes felt like kissing on her bent yellowish nape, or to a jolly thick-set fellow who had served in the Imperial Navy, who said, "Yes, aye, aye," and "Abmazgavat" to dope it out, and was preparing "Dat Drapo" to blow to Mexico. Escaping secretly from his mistress, a 200-pound, passionate and doleful old woman who had happened to flee to Finland in the same sleigh as he, and since then, in perpetual jealous despair, had been feeding him meat pies, cream pudding, pickled mushrooms. Besides these English lessons, there were lucrative commercial translations, reports on the low sound conductivity of tile floors, or treatises about ball bearings. And finally, a modest but particularly precious income came from his lyrical poems, which he composed in a kind of drunken trance, and always with that same nostalgic, patriotic fervor. Some of them did not materialize in final form, dissolving instead, fertilizing the innermost depths, while others, completely polished and equipped with all their commas, were taken to the newspaper office, first via a subway train with glinting reflections rapidly ascending its vertical stangs of brass, then, in the strange emptiness of an enormous elevator, to the 9th floor, where, at the end of a corridor, the color of gray modeling clay, in a narrow little room smelling of the decaying corpse of actuality, as the number one office comic used to crack, sat the secretary, a moon-like, phlegmatic person, ageless and virtually sexless, who had more than once saved the day when, angered by some item in Vasiliev's liberal paper, menacing rowdies would come, German Trotskyists hired locally, or some robust Russian fascist, a rogue and a mystic. The telephone jangled. Ripley proofs breezed past. The theater critic kept on reading a stray Russian newspaper from Vilna. "Why, do we owe you money?" "Nothing of the kind," the secretary would say. When the door to the room on the right opened, one could hear the juicily dictating voice of Goetz, or Stupishin clearing his throat, and among the clatter of several typewriters one could make out the swift rat-a-tat of Tamara. At the left was Vasiliev's office. His lustrine jacket grew tight across his plump shoulders as, standing before the lectern he used as a writing table and puffing like some powerful machine, he wrote the leading article in his untidy handwriting with its schoolroom blots, headed "No Improvement in Sight," or "The Situation in China." Suddenly stopping, lost in thought, he made a noise like a metal scraper as he scratched his large, bearded cheek with one finger and narrowed his eye, overhung by a raffish black brow without a single gray hair in it, remembered in Russia to this day. By the window, outside which there was a similar multi-office building, with repairs going on so high in the sky that it seemed as though they might as well do something about the ragged rent in the gray cloud bank, stood a bowl with an orange and a half and an appetizing jar of yogurt, and in the bookcase, in its locked bottom compartment, forbidden cigars and a large blue and red heart were preserved. A table was cluttered with the old trash of Soviet newspapers, cheap books with lurid covers, letters, requesting, reminding, rebuking, the squeezed-out half of an orange, a newspaper page with a window cut out, and a portrait photograph of Vasiliev's daughter, who lived in Paris, a young woman with a charming bare shoulder and smoky hair. She was an unsuccessful actress, and there was frequent mention of her in the cinema column of the Gazeta. Our talented compatriot Sylvina Lee, although no one had ever heard of the compatriot. Vasiliev would good-humoredly accept Fyodor's poems and print them, not because he liked them, generally he did not even read them, but because it was absolutely immaterial to him what adorned the non-political part of his paper. Having ascertained once for all the level of literacy below which a given contributor by nature could not fall, Vasiliev gave him a free hand, even if the given level barely rose above zero. And poems, since they were mere trifles, passed almost entirely without control, trickling through openings where rubbish of greater weight and volume would have got stuck. But what joyful, exciting squealing arose in all the peacock coops of our émigré poetry from Latvia to the Riviera. They printed mine, and mine. Fyodor himself, who felt that he had only one rival, Koncheyev, who, by the way, was not a contributor to the Gazeta, did not concern himself with his neighbors in print, and rejoiced over his poems no less than the others. There were times when he could not wait for the evening mail that brought his copy, and instead would buy one half an hour earlier in the street, and shamelessly, scarcely having left the newsstand, catching the reddish light near the fruit stands where mountains of oranges glowed in the blue of early twilight, would unfold the paper and sometimes find nothing. Something else had squeezed it out. But if he found it, he would gather the pages more conveniently and, resuming his progress along the sidewalk, read his poem over several times, varying the inner intonations. That is, imagining one by one the various mental ways the poem would be read, perhaps was now being read by those whose opinion he considered important. And with each of these different incarnations, he would almost physically feel a change in the color of his eyes, and also in the color behind his eyes, and in the taste in his mouth. And the more he liked the chef-d'oeuvre du jour, the more perfectly and succulently he could read it through the eyes of others. Having thus dawdled away the summer, having given birth to, raised, and stopped loving forever some 24 poems, he went out one clear and cool day, a Saturday, tonight is the meeting, to make an important purchase. The fallen leaves lay not flat on the sidewalk, but warped and stiffly crumpled, so that from under each protruded a blue corner of shadow. Carrying a broom, the little old woman in a clean apron, with a small, sharp face and disproportionately large feet, came out of her gingerbread cottage with its candy windows. Yes, it was autumn. He walked happily. Everything was fine. Morning had brought a letter from his mother, who was planning to come and visit him at Christmas. And through his deteriorating summer footwear, he felt the ground with extraordinary sensitivity when he walked across an unpaved section next to deserted vegetable garden plots with their faint burnt odor, between houses which turned the sliced-off blackness of their outer walls toward them. And there, in front of lacy bowers, grew cabbages beaded with large bright drops, and the bluish stalks of withered carnations and sunflowers, their heavy bulldog faces bowed. For a long time, he had wanted to express somehow that it was in his feet that he had the feeling of Russia, that he could touch and recognize all of her with his soles, as a blind man feels with his palms. And it was a pity when he reached the end of that stretch of rich brown earth and once again had to step along the resonant sidewalk. A young woman in a black dress with a shiny forehead and quick wandering eyes sat down at his feet for the eighth time, sideways on a stool, nimbly extracting a narrow shoe from the rustling interior of its box, spread her elbows apart as she slackened the edges, glanced abstractedly aside as she loosened the laces, and then, producing a shoehorn from her bosom, addressed Fyodor's large, shy, poorly darned foot. Miraculously, the foot fit inside, but having done so, went completely blind. The wiggling of toes inside had no effect on the exterior smoothness of the taut black leather. With phenomenal speed, the salesgirl tied the lace ends and touched the tip of the shoe with two fingers. "Just right," she said. "New shoes are always a little..." She went on rapidly, raising her brown eyes. "Of course, if you wish, we can make some adjustments, but they fit perfectly. See for yourself." And she led him to the X-ray gadget and showed him where to place his foot. Looking down in the glass aperture, he saw against a luminous background his own dark, neatly separated phalanges. With this I'll step ashore, from Cairns Ferry. Putting on the other shoe as well, he walked along the carpet the length of the store and back, glancing sideways at the ankle-high mirror, which reflected his beautified step and his trouser leg, now looking twice its age. "Yes, they're fine," he said cravenly. When he was a child, they used to scrape the glossy black sole with a button hook so it would not be slippery. He carried them off to his lesson under his arm, came home, ate, put them on, admiring them apprehensively, and left for the meeting. They do seem all right after all, for an agonizing beginning. The meeting was at the smallish, pathetically ornate flat of some relatives of Lyubov Markovna's. A red-haired girl in a green dress that ended above her knees was helping the Estonian maid, who was conversing with her in a loud whisper, to serve the tea. Among the familiar crowd, which contained few new faces, Fyodor at once descried Koncheyev, who was attending for the first time. He looked at the round-shouldered, almost humpbacked figure of this unpleasantly quiet man, whose mysteriously growing talent could have been checked only by a ringful of poison in a glass of wine, this all-comprehending man, with whom he had never yet had a chance to have the good talk he dreamt of having some day, and in whose presence he, writhing, burning, and hopelessly summoning his own poems to come to his aid, felt himself a mere contemporary. That young face was of the Central Russian type, and seemed a little common in a kind of oddly old-fashioned way. It was bounded above by wavy hair, and below by starched collar wings, and at first in the presence of this man Fyodor experienced a glum discomfort. But three ladies were smiling at him from the sofa. Chernyshevsky was salaaming to him from afar. Getz was raising like a banner a magazine he had brought for him, which contained Koncheyev's Beginning of a Long Poem, and an article by Christopher Mortus entitled The Voice of Pushkin's Mary in Contemporary Poetry. Behind him, somebody pronounced with the intonation of an explanatory response, Godunov Cherdintsev. Never mind, Fyodor thought rapidly, smiling to himself, looking around and tapping the end of a cigarette against his eagle-emblazoned cigarette case. Never mind, we'll still clink eggs some day, he and I, and we'll see whose will crack. Tamara was indicating a vacant chair to him, and as he made his way to it, he again thought he heard the sonorous ring of his name. When young people of his age, lovers of poetry, followed him on occasion with that special gaze that glides like a swallow across a poet's mirrory heart, he would feel inside him the chill of a quickening, bracing pride. It was the forerunner of his future fame. But there was also another earthly fame, the faithful echo of the past. He was proud of the attention of his young coevals, but no less proud of the curiosity of older people who saw in him the son of a great explorer, a courageous eccentric who had discovered new animals in Tibet, the Pamirs, and other blue lands. Here, said Madame Chernyshevsky with her dewy smile, I want you to meet... She introduced him to one Skvortsov, who had recently escaped from Moscow. He was a friendly fellow, had ray-like lines around his eyes, a pear-shaped nose, a thin beard, and a dapper, youthful, melodiously talkative little wife in a silk shawl. In short, a couple of that more or less academic type that was so familiar to Fyodor through his memory of the people who used to flicker around his father. Skvortsov, in courteous and correct terms, began by expressing his amazement at the total lack of information abroad about the circumstances surrounding the death of Konstantin Kirillovich. We'd thought, his wife put in, that if nobody knew anything back home, that was to be expected. Yes, Skvortsov continued, I recall terribly clearly how one day I happened to be present at a dinner in honor of your father, and how Kozlov, Pyotr Kuzmich, the explorer, remarked wittily that Godunov Cherdintsev looked upon Central Asia as his private game reserve. Yes, that was quite a time ago. I don't think you were born then. At this point, Fyodor suddenly noticed that Madame Chernyshevsky was directing a sorrowful, meaningful, sympathy-laden gaze at him. Curtly interrupting Skvortsov, he began questioning him, without much interest, about Russia. How shall I put it? Replied the latter. You see, it's like this. Hello, dear Fyodor Konstantinovich. A fat lawyer who resembled an overfed turtle shouted this over Fyodor's head, although already shaking his hand while pushing through the crowd, and by now he was already greeting someone else. Then Vasilyev rose from his seat and, leaning lightly on the table for a moment with splayed fingers in a position peculiar to shopkeepers and orators, announced that the meeting was opened. Mr. Bush, he added, will now read us his new philosophical tragedy. Hermann Ivanovich Bush, an elderly, shy, solidly built, likable gentleman from Riga, with a head that looked like Beethoven's, seated himself at the little Empire table, emitted a throaty rumble, and unfolded his manuscript. His hands trembled perceptibly and continued to tremble throughout the reading. From the very beginning, it was apparent that the road led to disaster. The Regan's farcical accent and bizarre solecisms were incompatible with the obscurity of his meaning. When already in the prologue there appeared a lone companion, Odinoki Sputnik instead of Odinoki Putnik, lone wayfarer, walking along that road, Fyodor still hoped against hope that this was a metaphysical paradox and not a traitorous lapsus. The chief of the town guard, not admitting the traveler, repeated several times that he would not pass definitely, rhyming with nightly. The town was a coastal one. The lone companion was coming from the hinterland, and the crew of a Greek vessel was carousing there. This conversation went on in the street of sin. First prostitute. All is water. That is what my client Thales says. Second prostitute. Oh, all is air. Young Anaximenes told me. Third prostitute. All is number. My bald Pythagoras cannot be wrong. Fourth prostitute. Heracles caresses me, whispering, all is fire. Lone companion enters. All is fate. There were also two choruses, one of which somehow managed to represent the de Broglie's waves and the logic of history, while the other chorus, the good one, argued with it. First sailor, second sailor, third sailor, continued Bush, enumerating the conversing characters in his nervous bass voice, edged with moisture. There also appeared three flower vendors, a lilies woman, a violets woman, and a woman of different flowers. Suddenly, something gave. Little landslides began among the audience. Before long, certain power lines formed in various directions all across the room, a network of exchanged glances between three or four, then five or six, then 10 people, which represented a third of the gathering. Koncheyev slowly and carefully took a large volume from the bookshelf near which he was sitting. Fyodor noticed that it was an album of Persian miniatures, and just as slowly turning it this way and that in his lap, he began to glance through it with myopic eyes. Madame Chernyshevsky wore a surprised and hurt expression, but in keeping with her secret ethics, somehow tied up with the memory of her son, she was forcing herself to listen. Bush was reading rapidly. His glossy jowls gyrated, the horseshoe in his black tie sparkled, while beneath the table his feet stood pigeon-toed. And as the idiotic symbolism of the tragedy became ever deeper, more involved, and less comprehensible, the painfully repressed, subterraneously raging hilarity more and more desperately needed an outlet, and many were already bending over, afraid to look. And when the dance of the maskers began in the square, someone, Getz it was, coughed, and together with the cough there issued a certain additional whoop, whereupon Getz covered his face with his hands and after a while emerged again with a senselessly bright countenance and humid bald head, while on the couch Tamara had simply lain down and was rocking as if in the throes of labor, while Fyodor, who was deprived of protection, shed floods of tears, tortured by the forced noiselessness of what was going on inside him. Unexpectedly, Vasilyev turned in his chair so ponderously that a leg collapsed with a crack, and Vasilyev lurched forward with a changed expression, but did not fall. And this event, not funny in itself, served as a pretext for an elemental orgiastic explosion to interrupt the reading. And while Vasilyev was transferring his bulk to another chair, Hermann Ivanovich Bush, knitting his magnificent but quite unfruitful brow, jotted something on the manuscript with a pencil stub, and in the relieved calm, an unidentified woman uttered something in a separate, final moan. But Bush was already going on. Lily's woman, you're all upset about something today, sister. Woman of different flowers. Yes, the fortune-teller told me that my daughter would marry yesterday's passer-by. Daughter, oh, I did not even notice him. Lily's woman. And he did not notice her. Hear, hear, chimed in the chorus, as in the British Parliament. Again there was a slight commotion. An empty cigarette box, on which the fat lawyer had written something, began a journey across the whole room, and everybody followed the stages of its trip. Something extremely funny must have been written on it, but no one read it, and it was passed dutifully from hand to hand, destined for Fyodor. And when it finally reached him, he read on it, "Later, I want to discuss a certain little affair with you." The last act was nearing its conclusion. The god of laughter imperceptibly forsook Fyodor, and he gazed meditatively at the shine of his shoe, onto the cold shore from the ferry. The right one pinched more than the left. Koncheyev, his mouth half open, was leafing through the final pages of the album. "Zanaves!" "Curtain!" exclaimed Bush, accenting the last syllable instead of the first. Vasilyev announced that there would be an intermission. Most of the audience had a rumpled and wilted look, as after a night in a third-class coach. Bush had rolled his tragedy into a thick tube and was standing in a far corner, and it seemed to him that in the din of voices there formed and spread constant ripples of admiration. Lyubov Markovna offered him some tea, and then his powerful face suddenly assumed a defenseless, gentle expression, and blissfully licking his lips, he bent toward the glass that had been handed him. Fyodor observed this from afar with a certain feeling of awe, while behind him he heard the following, "Please give me some explanation," the angry voice of Madame Chernyshevsky.
"Well, you know, such things do happen," guiltily debonair Vasilyev.
"I ask you for an explanation."
"But, my dear lady, what can I do now?"
"Well, didn't you read it beforehand? Didn't he bring it to you at the office? I thought you said it was a serious, interesting work, a significant work."
"Well, that's true. The first expression, you know, when I skimmed it, I did not take into consideration how it would sound. I was fooled. It's really baffling. Go over to him, Alexander Yakovlevna. Say something to him."
The lawyer grasped Fyodor above the elbow. "You're just the person I'm looking for. It suddenly occurred to me that there is something for you here. A client of mine came to me. He requires a German translation of some papers of his for a divorce case, don't you see? The Germans who are handling the affair for him have a Russian girl in their office, but apparently she will be able to do only part of it, and they need someone to help her out with the rest. Would you want to take this? Here, let me take your telephone number." "Gemacht."
"Ladies and gentlemen, be seated, please," rang out Vasilyev's voice. "Now we shall have a discussion of the work that has been read. Those who wish to participate, please sign up."
Just then Fyodor saw that Koncheyev, stooping and with his hand behind his lapel, was making a serpentine course toward the exit. Fyodor followed, nearly forgetting his magazine in the process. In the anteroom they were joined by old Stupishin. He frequently moved from one rented room to another, but lived always so far from the center of the city that these changes, important and complicated for him, seemed to others to happen in an ethereal world beyond the horizon of human worry. Draping a skimpy, gray-striped scarf around his neck, he held it in place with his chin in the Russian manner, while also in the Russian manner he got into his overcoat by means of several dorsal jerks.
"Well, he certainly gave us a treat," he said as they descended,
accompanied by the maid with the front door key. "I confess I didn't listen very carefully," commented Koncheyev. Stupishin went to wait for a rare, almost legendary streetcar, while Godunov, Cherdintsev, and Koncheyev set out in the opposite direction to walk as far as the corner.
"What nasty weather," said Godunov, Cherdintsev.
"Yes, it's quite cold," agreed Koncheyev.
"Rotten. And what part do you live?"
"Charlottenburg."
"Well, well, that's quite a way. You're walking?"
"Oh, yes, walking. I think that here I must..."
"Yes, you turn right. I go straight."
They said goodbye.
"Ooh, what a wind.
Wait a minute, though. I'll see you home. Surely you're a night owl like me, and I don't have to expound to you on the black enchantment of stone promenades."
"So you didn't listen to our poor lecturer?"
"Only at the beginning, and then only with half an ear. However, I don't think it was quite as bad as that."
"You were examining Persian miniatures in a book. Did you not notice one, an amazing resemblance, from the collection of the St. Petersburg Public Library, done, I think, by Riza Abbasi?"
say about 300 years ago? That man kneeling, struggling with baby dragons? Big-nosed, mustachioed? Stalin. Yes, I think that was one is the strongest of the lot. By the way, I've read your very remarkable collection of poems. Actually, of course, they are but the models of your future novels. Yes, someday I'm going to produce prose in which thought and music are conjoined as are the folds of life in sleep. Thanks for the courteous quotation. You have a genuine love of literature, don't you? I believe so. You see, the way I look at it, there are only two kinds of books, bedside and wastebasket. Either I love a writer fervently or throw him out entirely. Well, a bit severe, isn't it? And a bit dangerous. Don't forget that the whole of Russian literature is the literature of one century, and after the most lenient eliminations, takes up no more than 3 to 3,500 printed sheets. And scarcely one half of this is worthy of the bookshelf, to say nothing of the bedside table. With such quantitative scantiness, we must resign ourselves to the fact that our Pegasus is piebald, that not everything about a bad writer is bad, and not all about a good one good. Perhaps you will give me some examples, so that I can refute them. Certainly. If you open Goncharov, or stop right there. Don't tell me you have a kind word for Oblomov, that first Ilyich who was the ruin of Russia and the joy of social critics. Or you want to discuss the miserable hygienic conditions of Victorian seductions, crinoline and damp garden bench, or perhaps the style. What about his precipice, where Raisky, at moments of pensiveness, is shown with rosy moisture shimmering between his lips, which reminds me somehow of Pisemsky's protagonists, each of whom, under the stress of violent emotion, massages his chest with his hand. Here I shall trap you. Aren't there some good things in the same Pisemsky? For example, those footmen in the vestibule, during a ball, who play catch with a lady's velveteen boot, horribly muddy and worn. Uh-huh. And since we're speaking of second-rank authors, what do you think of Liskov? Well, let me see. Amusing anglicisms crop up in his style, such as «Это была дурная вещь», this was a bad thing, instead of simply «плохо дело». As to his contrived punning distortions, no, spare me, I don't find them funny. And his verbosity, good God, his «собрание», could easily be condensed to two newspaper feuilletons, and I don't know which is worse, his virtuous Britishers or his virtuous clerics. And yet, how about his image of Jesus, the ghostly Galilean, cool and gentle, in a robe the color of ripening plum? Or his description of a yawning dog's mouth with its bluish palate as if smeared with pomade? Or that lightning of his that at night illumines the room in detail, even to the magnesium oxide left on a silver spoon. Yes, I grant you he has a Latin feeling for blueness, lividus. Lev Tolstoy, on the other hand, preferred violet shades, and the bliss of stepping barefoot with the rooks upon the rich dark soil of ploughed fields. Of course, I should never have bought them. You're right, they pinch unbearably, but we have moved up to the first rank. Don't tell me you can't find weak spots there, too. In such stories as The Blizzard, leave Pushkin alone. He is the gold reserve of our literature. And over there is Chekhov's hamper, which contains enough food for years to come, and a whimpering puppy, and a bottle of Crimean wine. Wait, let's go back to the forebears. Gogol? I think we can accept his entire organism. Turgenev, Dostoevsky, Bedlam turned back into Bethlehem. That's Dostoevsky for you. With one reservation, as our friend Mortu says. In the Karamazovs, there is somewhere a circular mark left by a wet wine glass on an outdoor table. That's worth saving if one uses your approach. Oh, don't tell me all is well with Turgenev. Remember those inept tete-a-tetes in acacia arbors? The growling and quivering of Bazarov, his highly unconvincing fussing with those frogs. And, in general, I don't know if you can stand the particular intonation of the Turgenevian row of dots at the close of a fading phrase, and the maudling endings of his chapters. Or should we forgive all his sins because of the gray sheen of Madame Odintsev's black silks and the outstretched hind legs of some of his graceful sentences, those rabbit-like postures assumed by his resting hounds? My father used to find all kinds of howlers in Turgenev's and Tolstoy's hunting scenes and descriptions of nature. And as for the wretched Aksakov, let's not even discuss his disgraceful blunders in that field. Now that the dead bodies have been removed, we might perhaps proceed to the poets. All right. By the way, speaking of dead bodies, has it ever occurred to you that in Lermontov's most famous short poem, the familiar corpse at the end is extremely funny? What he really wanted to say was corpse of the man she once knew. The posthumous acquaintance is unjustified and meaningless. Of late, it's Tchutchev who shares my night lodgings most often. A worthy houseguest. And how do you feel about Nekrasov's iambics, or don't you have a taste for him? Oh, I do. There is in his best verse a certain guitar twang, a sob and a gasp, which, for instance, Fiet, a more refined artist, somehow lacks. I have a feeling that Fiet's secret weakness is his rationality and stress on antitheses. This hasn't escaped you, has it? Our oafish school of social intent writers criticized him for the wrong reasons. No, I can forgive him everything for rang out in the darkening meadow, for dew tears of rapture shed the night, for the wing-fanning, breathing butterfly. And so we move on to the next century. Mind the step. You and I began to rave about poetry in our boyhood, didn't we? Refresh my memory. How did it go? How the rims of the clouds palpitate. Poor old Balmont. Or illuminated from Blockside, clouds of chimerical solace. Oh, but it would have been a crime to be choosy here. My mind in those days accepted ecstatically, gratefully, completely, without critical carpings, all of the five poets whose names began with B, the five senses of the new Russian poetry. I'd be interested to know which of the five represents taste. Yes, yes, I know. There are aphorisms that, like airplanes, stay up only while they are in motion. But we were talking about the dawn. How did it begin with you? When my eyes opened to the alphabet. Sorry, that sounds pretentious, but the fact is, since childhood, I've been afflicted with the most intense and elaborate audition colorée. So that you, too, like Rimbaud, could have written not a mere sonnet, but a fat opus with auditive hues he never dreamt of. For instance, the various numerous A's of the four languages which I speak differ for me in tinge, going from lacquered black to splintery gray, like different sorts of wood. I can recommend to you my pink flannel M. I don't know if you remember the insulating cotton wool which was removed with the storm windows in spring. Well, that is my Russian Y, or rather so grubby and dull that words are ashamed to begin with it. If I had some paints handy, I would mix burnt sienna and sepia for you so as to match the color of a gutta-percha ch sound, and you would appreciate my radiant S if I could pour into your cupped hands some of those luminous sapphires that I touched as a child, trembling and not understanding when my mother dressed for a ball, uncontrollably sobbing, allowed her perfectly celestial treasures to flow out of their abyss into her palm, out of their cases onto black velvet, and then suddenly locked everything up and did not go anywhere after all, in spite of the impassioned persuasions of her brother, who kept pacing up and down the rooms, giving fillips to the furniture and shrugging his epaulets. And if one turned the curtain slightly on the side window of the oriel, one could see along the receding river front facades in the blue blackness of the night, the motionless magic of an imperial illumination, the ominous blaze of diamond monograms, colored bulbs in coronal designs. Buchstaben von Feuer, in short. Yes, I know what is coming. Shall I finish this banal and soul-rending tale for you? How you delighted in any poem that happened along, how at 10 you were writing dramas and at 15 elegies, and all about sunsets, sunsets. Blocks incognita who passed slowly in between the drunkards. By the way, who was she? A young married woman. It lasted a little less than 2 years until my escape from Russia. She was lovely and sweet, you know. with large eyes and slightly bony hands. And somehow I have remained faithful to her even to this day. Her taste in poetry was limited to fashionable gypsy lyrics. She adored poker, and she died of typhus. God knows where, God knows how. And what comes now? Would you say it's worth going on writing verse? Oh, decidedly, to the very end. Even at this moment, I'm happy in spite of the degrading pain in my pinched toes. To tell the truth, I again feel that turbulence, that excitement. Once again, I shall spend the whole night. Show me. Let's see how it works. It is with this that from the slow black ferry. No, try again. Through snow that falls on water never freezing, keep trying. Under the vertical slow snow in gray enjambment Lethean weather in the usual season, with this I'll step upon the shore some day. That's better, but be careful not to squander the excitement. Oh, that's all right. My point is that one cannot help being happy with this tingling sensation in the skin of your brow, as from an excess of vinegar in chopped beet. Do you know what has just occurred to me? That river is not the Lethe, but rather the Styx. Never mind, let's proceed. And now a crooked bough looms near the ferry, and Charon, with his boat-hook in the dark, reaches for it and catches it, and very slowly the bark revolves, the silent bark. Homeward, homeward. I feel tonight like composing with pen in hand. What a moon! What a black smell of leaves and earth from behind those railings! And what a pity no one has overheard the brilliant colloquy that I would have liked so much to hold with you. Never mind, it won't be wasted. In fact, I'm glad it turned out this way. Whose business is it that actually we parted at the very first corner, and that I've been reciting a fictitious dialogue with myself, as supplied by a self-teaching handbook of literary inspiration? Chapter 2. The rain still fell lightly, but with the elusive suddenness of an angel, a rainbow had already appeared. In languorous self-wonder, pinkish-green with a purplish suffusion along its inner edge, it hung suspended over the reaped field, above and before a distant wood, one tremulous portion of which showed through it. Stray arrows of rain that had lost both rhythm and weight and the ability to make any sound flashed at random this way and that in the sun. Up the rain-washed sky, from behind a raven cloud, a cloud of ravishing whiteness was extricating itself and shining with all the detail of a monstrously complicated molding. "Well, well, it's over," he said in a low voice, and emerged from under the shelter of aspens that crowded where the greasy, clayey Zemskaya rural district road, and what a bump in this designation, descended into a hollow, gathering there all its ruts into an oblong pit full to the brim with thick café crème. My darling, pattern of Elysian hues. Once in Ordos, my father, climbing a hill after a storm, inadvertently entered the base of a rainbow, the rarest occurrence, and found himself in colored air, in a play of light as if in paradise. He took one more step and left paradise. The rainbow was already fading. The rain had quite stopped. It was scorching hot. A horsefly with satiny eyes settled on his sleeve. A cuckoo began to call in a copse, listlessly, almost questioningly. The sound swelled like a cupule, and again like a cupule unable to find a solution. The poor fat bird probably flew further away, for everything was repeated from the beginning in the manner of a reduced reflection. It sought, who knows, a place for the best, the saddest effect. A huge butterfly, flat in flight, bluish-black with a white band, described a supernaturally smooth arc, settled on the damp earth, closed its wings, and with that disappeared. This is the kind that now and then a panting peasant lad brings one, cramming it with both hands into his cap. This is the kind that soars up from under the mincing hooves of the doctor's well-behaved little pony, when the doctor, holding the almost superfluous reins in his lap, or else simply tying them to the front board, pensively drives along the shady road to the hospital. But on occasion, you find four black-and-white wings with brick-colored undersides scattered like playing cards over a forest footpath, the rest eaten by an unknown bird. He jumped a puddle where two dung beetles had fastened onto a straw getting in each other's way, and printed his soul on the edge of the road. A highly significant footprint, ever looking upward and ever seeing him who has vanished. Walking through a field alone, beneath the magnificently rushing clouds, he remembered how, with his first cigarettes and his first cigarette case, he had approached an old reaper here and asked for a light. The peasant had taken out a box from his gaunt breast and given it to him unsmilingly. But the wind was blowing. Match after match went out before it had hardly flared, and after every one he grew more ashamed, while the man watched with a kind of detached curiosity the impatient fingers of the wasteful young squire. He went deeper into the woods. Planks had been laid along the path, black and slimy, with reddish-brown ammants and leaves that had stuck to them. Who was this had dropped a rustula, breaking open its white fan? In reply came the sound of hallooing. Girls were gathering mushrooms and bilberries, the latter seeming so much darker in the basket than on their stalks. Among the birches there was an old acquaintance with a double trunk, a birch lyre, and beside it an old post with a board on it. Nothing could be made out on it except bullet marks. A Browning had once been fired at it by his English tutor, also Browning, and then father had taken the pistol, swiftly and dexterously ramming bullets into the clip, and knocked out a smooth K with 7 shots. Farther on, a bog orchis bloomed unceremoniously in a patch of marshy ground, behind which he had to cross a back road, and off to the right a white wicket gate gleamed, the entrance to the park. Trimmed with ferns outside, luxuriantly lined with jasmine and honeysuckle inside, in places darkened by fir needles, in others lightened by birch leaves, this huge, dense, and multipathed park stood poised in an equilibrium of sun and shadow, which formed from night to night a variable, but in its variability a uniquely characteristic, harmony. If circles of warm light palpitated underfoot in the avenue, then a thick velvet stripe was sure to stretch across in the distance. Behind it again came that tawny sieve, while further at the bottom there deepened a rich blackness that, transferred to paper, would satisfy the watercolorist only as long as the paint remained wet, so that he would have to put on layer after layer to retain its beauty, which would immediately fade. All paths led to the house, but geometry notwithstanding, it seemed the quickest way was not by the straight avenue, slim and sleek with a sensitive shadow rising like a blind woman to meet you and touch your face, and with a burst of emerald sunlight at the very end, but by any of its tortuous and unweeded neighbors. He walked along his favorite one toward the still invisible house, past the bench on which, according to established tradition, his parents used to sit on the eve of his father's regular departures on his travels. Father, knees apart, twirling his spectacles or a carnation in his hands, had his head lowered, with a boater tipped onto the back of it, and with a taciturn, almost mocking smile around his puckered eyes and in the soft corners of his mouth, somewhere in the very roots of his trimmed beard. And mother was telling him something, from the side, from below, from beneath her large, trembling white hat, or was pressing out crunchy little holes in the dumb sand with the tip of a parasol. He walked past a boulder with rowan saplings clambering onto it. One had turned to offer a hand to the younger, past a small grass-grown plat which had been a pond in grandfather's time, and past some shortish fir trees which used to become quite round in winter under their burden of snow. The snow used to fall straight and slow. It could fall like that for 3 days, 5 months, 9 years. And already, ahead, in a clear space traversed by white specks, one glimpsed a dim yellow blotch approaching, which suddenly came into focus, shuddered, thickened, and turned into a tram car. And the wet snow drifted slantingly, plastering over the left face of a pillar of glass, the tram stop, while the asphalt remained black and bare, as if incapable by nature of accepting anything white. And among the signs over chemist shops, stationers, and grocers, which swam before the eyes and at first were even incomprehensible, only one could still appear to be written in Russian, cacao. Meanwhile, around him, everything that had just been imagined with such pictorial clarity, which in itself was suspicious, like the vividness of dreams at the wrong time of day or after a soporific, paled, corroded, disintegrated. And if one looked around, then, as in a fairy tale the stairs disappear behind the back of whoever is mounting them, everything collapsed and disappeared. A farewell configuration of trees, standing like people come to see someone off, and already swept away. A scrap of rainbow faded in the wash, the path, of which there remained only the gesture of a turn, a butterfly on a pin with only 3 wings and no abdomen, a carnation in the sand, by the shade of the bench, the very last, most persistent odds and ends. And in another moment, all this yielded Fyodor without a struggle to his present, and straight out of his reminiscences, swift and senseless, visiting him like an attack of a fatal illness at any hour, in any place, straight from the hothouse paradise of the past, he stepped onto a Berlin tram car. He was going to a lesson, was late as usual, and as usual there grew in him a vague, evil, heavy hatred for the clumsy sluggishness of this least gifted of all methods of transport, for the hopelessly familiar, hopelessly ugly streets going by the wet window, and most of all, for the feet, sides, and necks of the native passengers. His reason knew that they could also include genuine, completely human individuals with unselfish passions, pure sorrows, even with memories shining through life, but for some reason he got the impression that all these cold, slippery eyes looking at him as if he were carrying an illegal treasure, which his gift was, essentially, belonged only to malicious hags and crooked hucksters. The Russian conviction that the German is in small numbers vulgar, and in large numbers unbearably vulgar, was, he knew, a conviction unworthy of an artist. But nonetheless, he was seized with a trembling, and only the gloomy conductor with hunted eyes and a plaster on his finger, eternally and painfully seeking equilibrium and room to pass amidst the convulsive jolts of the car and the cattle-like crowding of standing passengers, seemed outwardly, if not a human being, then at least a poor relation to a human being. At the second stop, a lean man in a short coat with a fox fur collar, wearing a green hat and frayed spats, sat down in front of Fyodor. In settling down, he bumped him with his knee and with the corner of a fat briefcase with a leather handle, and this trivial thing turned his irritation into a kind of pure fury, so that, staring fixedly at the sitter, reading his features, he instantly concentrated on him all his sinful hatred for this poor, pitiful, expiring nation, and knew precisely why he hated him. For that low forehead, for those pale eyes, for Vollmilch and extra stark, implying the lawful existence of the diluted and the artificial, for the Punchinello-like system of gestures, threatening children not as we do, with an upright finger, a standing reminder of divine judgment, but with a horizontal digit imitating a waving stick, for a love of fences, rows, mediocrity, for the cult of the office, for the fact that if you listen to his inner voice or to any conversation on the street, you will inevitably hear figures, money, for the lavatory humor and crude laughter, for the fatness of the backsides of both sexes, even if the rest of the subject is not fat, for the lack of fastidiousness, for the visibility of cleanliness,
the gleam of saucepan bottoms in the kitchen, and the barbaric filth of the bathrooms. For the weakness for dirty little tricks, for taking pains with dirty tricks, for the abominable object stuck carefully on the railings of the public gardens, for someone else's live cat pierced through with wire as revenge on a neighbor, and the wire cleverly twisted at one end, for cruelty in everything, self-satisfied, taken for granted, for the unexpected, rapturous helpfulness with which five passers-by help you to pick up some dropped farthings, for... Thus he threaded the points of his biased indictment, looking at the man who sat opposite him, until the latter took a copy of Vasiliev's newspaper from his pocket and coughed unconcernedly with a Russian intonation. "That's wonderful," thought Fyodor, almost smiling with delight. "How clever, how gracefully sly, and how essentially good life is." Now he made out in the newspaper reader's features such a compatriotic softness in the corners of the eyes, large nostrils, a Russian-cut moustache, that it became at once both funny and incomprehensible how anyone could have been deceived. His thoughts were cheered by this unexpected respite and had already taken a different turn. The pupil he was visiting was a scantily educated but inquisitive old Jew, who the previous year had conceived a sudden desire to learn how to chat in French, which seemed to the old man both more attainable and more becoming to his years, character, and experience of life than the dry study of the grammar of a language. Invariably, at the beginning of the lesson, groaning and mixing a multitude of Russian and German words with a pinch of French, he described his exhaustion after the day's work. He was manager of a sizable paper factory, and went from these lengthy complaints to a discussion in French, landing immediately up to the ears in hopeless darkness, of international politics, and with this demanded miracles, that all this wild, viscous, and ponderous stuff, comparable to the transportation of stones over a washed-out road, should turn suddenly into filigreed speech. Entirely lacking in the ability to remember words, and liking to talk of this not as a shortcoming, but as an interesting characteristic of his nature, he not only made no progress, but even managed in a year of studying to forget those few French phrases with which Fyodor had found him, and on the basis of which the old man had thought to construct in 3 or 4 evenings his own animated, light, portable Paris. Alas, the time passed fruitlessly, proving the futility of the effort and the impossibility of the dream. And then the instructor turned out to be inexperienced, completely lost, when the unfortunate factory manager suddenly needed exact information. What's dandy roll in French? Which, out of delicacy, the questioner immediately renounced, and both were momentarily embarrassed, like an innocent youth and maiden in some old idyll who inadvertently touch one another. It gradually became understandable. Since the pupil referred more and more despondently to the tiredness of his brain, and more often postponed the lessons, his secretary's heavenly voice on the telephone was the melody of happiness, it seemed to Fyodor that the latter had finally become convinced of his teacher's ineptitude, but that he was prolonging the mutual torment out of pity for his worn trousers, and would continue to do so to the grave. And now, sitting in the tramcar, he saw with ineffable vividness how in 7 or 8 minutes he would enter the familiar study, furnished in Berliner animal luxury, would settle in the deep leather armchair beside the low metal table with its glass cigarette box opened for him, and its lamp, fashioned like a terrestrial globe, would light a cigarette, cross his legs with cheap gaiety, and come face to face with the agonized, submissive gaze of his hopeless pupil, would hear so clearly his sigh and the ineradicable nouveau with which he interlarded his answers. But suddenly the unpleasant feeling of lateness was replaced in Fyodor's soul by a distinct and somehow outrageously joyful decision not to appear at all for the lesson, to get off at the next stop and return home to his half-read book,
to his unworldly cares, to the blissful mist in which his real life floated, to the complex, happy, devout work which had occupied him for about a year already. He knew that today he would receive payment for several lessons, knew that otherwise he would have to smoke and eat again on credit, but he was quite reconciled to this for the sake of that energetic idleness, everything is here in this combination, for the sake of the lofty truancy he was allowing himself. And he was allowing it not for the first time. Shy and exacting, living always uphill, spending all his strength in pursuit of the innumerable beings that flashed inside him as if at dawn in a mythological grove, he could no longer force himself to mix with people either for money or for pleasure, and therefore he was poor and solitary. And as if despite common fate, it was pleasant to recall how once in the summer he had not gone to a party in a suburban villa solely because the Chernyshevskys had warned him that a man would be there who perhaps could help him, or how the previous autumn he had not found time to communicate with a divorce bureau which needed a translator, because he was composing a verse drama, because the lawyer promising him this income was importunate and stupid, because, finally, he put it off too long and then was unable to make up his mind. He worked his way out onto the car's platform. Just then the wind searched him cruelly, after which Fyodor drew the belt of his Macintosh tighter and adjusted his scarf. But the small amount of tram warmth had already been taken away from him. The snow had ceased falling, but where it went no one knew. There remained only a ubiquitous dampness, which was evidenced both in the swishing sound of motor tires and in the pig-like sharpness of the ear-torturing, ragged squeal of car horns, and in the darkness of the day, shivering with cold, with sadness, with loathing for itself, and in the particular shade of yellow of the already lighted shop windows, in the reflections and refractions, in the liquid lights, in all this sick irritation of electric light. The tram came out on the square, and, braking excruciatingly, stopped. But it was only a preliminary stop, because in front, by the stone island crowded with people standing by to board, two other trams had got stuck, both with cars coupled on. And this inert agglomeration was also evident somehow of the disastrous imperfection of the world in which Fyodor still continued to reside.